Accession number 2106503.
Colonel Jenkins, Reel 3.
One of the things that happened in Rangoon, which was during the three weeks or whatever it was we were there, was Burma got independence. And I went as the subaltern to Government House in Rangoon. Sir Hubert Rance was the governor there. And I suppose it's rather a historic moment. One isn't involved in many of them, but I was the subaltern with the party that took down the British flag over the embassy in Rangoon, which finished up in our mess, actually, in Malaya. But that was the 4th of January, 1948, was the Burma Independence Day. And it's something I look back on. It was a date to remember, as far as every time the 4th of January comes around, I think of in Burma Independence Day. It was quite a ceremony.
Was Burma in a peaceful or disturbed condition?
At that time, it was just beginning to show signs of disintegration. I can't remember that somebody had been assassinated. I've forgotten his name. There was an Ung in it somewhere, but it was just starting to get a bit rough there. But I don't know any of the details. But of course, Burma has always been bit difficult, isn't it? But we went down to Malaya about the third week in January, I suppose, and arrived at Pry. My battalion, 1st 7th now, was destined for Seremban, which is in Negri Sembilan, and probably the most, I think, the most delightful town in Malaya. Lovely place. The 1st 6th went to Ipoh, and the 1st 10th, the 3rd battalion that was on the ship, went down to Johor Bahru, but we were based in Seremban. And looking forward to many years of peace, peaceful existence, having brought, when you think about it, all these battalions, I wasn't there, but had fought through Burma and in Africa and Italy. And then we were on the frontier, and we'd had internal security problems, IS duties, and now we were going down to Malaya as a lovely peaceful interlude. But of course, as everybody knows, that didn't last very long. In June 1948, just 6 months after we arrived, the first two or three planters were ambushed and killed, and the Malayan emergency started. And that, of course, was to last until right up to 1959, with all our battalions fully involved. By this time, of course, the brigade had been the other battalions of the 2nd, the 6th, the 7th and the 10th. I've only talked about three battalions. The other battalions had all come in from wherever they'd been. They were in India, in Bombay, in Calcutta, from various parts of India. They had all arrived in Malaya, and they were in bases. The 2nd Gurkhas were based in Singapore, became a base for the second. The 6th were in Ipoh, 7th were in Seremban, and the 10th were in Johor Bahru. And then in the June, the Malayan emergency started.
What duties did your battalion then have to take up?
Well, I suppose the Malayan emergency was the effects on the population were really mainly against planters and the planting community. It was trying, the services, the battalion's main task was to try and give some stability and security to the areas under threat. We had all the battalions of the brigade had a battalion headquarters in the places I've mentioned, but most of the rifle companies were spread out in their company areas in various camps which had been built to try and maintain some sort of order and to protect the community from the communists, the CTs.
So your battalion was operating in Negri Sembilan?
We were Negri Sembilan, yes. We had various places in Negri. We had a battalion attack headquarters up in Jelebu. We had we were all at Tampin. We of course there were British regiments there as well, in Malaya at this time. It wasn't totally a Gurkha place. So I don't know how many British battalions were there, but there were two or three, certainly two gunner regiments, and maybe three or four battalions of British soldiers. But we all had our areas of responsibility, and we had company bases from which we operated. All these company bases were established in near villages, barbed wire, sandbags, and the companies were permanently based there. They were reinforced usually by road, some by airdrop, and they were responsible, the company commanders were responsible for the security of their area, which mainly consisted, I think, of sending patrols out to into the jungle to try and locate any CT camps and to do something about it.
What was your job with the battalion at that time?
I was started off at that time by being I was the IO, and then they sent me to the intelligence officer, that is, and then they sent me back to England to do a signal course, and I became the battalion signal officer at that time, looking after communications.
What was the strength of the enemy in Negri Sembilan?
I don't know. I've never thought of that figure.
I don't mean in figures. I mean, was it a strong area?
Oh, well, they were doing their ambushes. I should imagine they were in parties of about camps of 150, that sort of thing, maybe two or three of them around about, but they were all in small groups patrolling. I don't know how many planters were killed, but it was quite a business. It was quite a nasty business. We lost our own CO in 1954. This is going on a bit, actually, in an ambush. And Alan Forrestry Walker, he was ambushed on the Jelebu Pass.
Were you with him then?
No, I wasn't with him, no. No, I was on leave in England, in fact, and I heard it on the radio.
Did you gather what had happened to him?
We knew exactly where he was coming back in a convoy of about five vehicles up the Jelebu Pass, which was a very winding pass, and all hell was let loose, and he was ambushed on the road. I think about five soldiers were killed with him. It was a very nasty business. But that was one of the things one was well aware of one of the threats in Malaya was the road ambush, because the jungle came down to the road in the initial stages, and of course the emergency went on for so many years that later on we learned our lessons, and then there was a big plan that on all roads where the jungle was adjacent to the road, the jungle was cleared back about 50-100 yards on each side of the road up in the hills, so that the enemy couldn't actually get near the road to start firing. But every battalion got casualties. I don't know what the casualty figures were, but I think my regiment lost two or three officers and a number wounded, and 50 or 60 men killed, I think. It was quite a business.
Did you go out on patrol yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Can you describe that, please?
We would be... take it that the company, I was a company commander for quite a lot of the time, and most of the time, I suppose, and my company would be, let's say we'd come back from an operation, we'd be in the lines, when we'd get a message to say that the CEO wanted to see you, and you'd go up and he'd say, well, look, there's something going on, and we want the company to go out into this area, and we would have a formal O group in which we would be made aware of what the threat was, what I was supposed to do, my mission, be it just general patrolling or to actually go and search out a CT camp or whatever. We would be given a period of days in which to operate, usually in multiples of five, because 5 days were a convenient load to carry of rations and various other bits and pieces of ammunition, what had you. We'd split that out between in the company, and a five-day operation was the usual. And if you were in jungle and not by a roadhead, you would take an airdrop. You'd have to, about every 5 days, you'd have an airdrop. You'd build a DZ, dropping zone, and order your supplies, and aeroplane Dakotas usually would come in and drop your rations. But it was a time when you spent many hours, the soldiers, in the jungle, and really, if you analyse it, very few contacts. It was like searching for a needle in a haystack, usually. But you were working, trying to work on information. The police were splendid, and their police stations were always a hive of activity. They were always trying to get information. They had various informers. They would have people on their pay books, Chinese and Malays, would come in and give them information. That would be passed through the various committees that they had with the military and the civil. And that's how the information came through to battalion headquarters, and the CO would then, in cooperation with the police, work out a little scheme. Because we were an aid to the civil power in Malaya, one must remember that. This wasn't just a war, this was aid to civil power. Police were the predominant arm, but of course they hadn't got the backup and the functions that the military had. We had the Air Force there, we had helicopters. In the early days, I mean, I remember in 1949, I was on an operation. I was a young officer at this stage. I wasn't a company commander. We had an airdrop. We had an airstrike in Bentong, and the bow fighters came from Ceylon. I mean, subsequently, in the late 1950s, if you wanted an airstrike, you got it within 2 hours from Singapore or somewhere. You know, it was very quick. But in those early days, we were in boots and gaiters and Gurkha hats. We weren't in jungle kit in those very early days, but that all changed, and everybody came quite professional jungle fighters, in fact, towards the end. But the emergency went on until, 1959.
Which company did you have?
My company. Well, I think I had C company first, and then B company most of my time.
Any contacts with the enemy personally that you can go through in detail, please?
I've got to now try and separate in my mind Malaya and Borneo, because they were very similar terrain and similar things, and one's trying to... I don't think in Malaya that I had any contacts. I did many hours of patrolling, but I don't think I had a personal contact. I was in support of other people who had contacts, but I can't recall having a direct contact myself. My company, the companies I was with, the platoons, had contacts, but I can't visualize myself in any danger during the Malayan emergency.
How did you like doing these duties in Malaya?
Oh, it was tremendous fun. I mean, that might sound a bit odd, but it was. It was exciting. You were doing a job. You were with the soldiers you loved being with. It was... what would you be doing if you weren't doing that? You'd be sort of doing drill or something. And, oh, no, it was great. And you're, however uncomfortable the patrolling was, and the jungle patrolling, you thoroughly enjoyed doing it. It was something you'd been trained for. And periodically you were taken out of operations for a couple of months to retrain. There was always retraining going on.
How do you think the soldiers felt about it?
Well, the soldiers, I think, probably had the same view as we do. They'd have much preferred to be doing what we were doing then, rather than thumping up and down a drill square. And and so of course most of the soldiers in the 50s, which is what we're talking about, had the senior soldiers, the sergeants and sergeant majors and the Gurkha officers, had been in the war, of course, so it was just a continuation of operations as far as they were concerned.
And you always operated in Negrisambila?
No, not always. That was our main base in the early days. But of course, things happened that you were asked to go and reinforce another battalion or whatever. And we operated in Johor. We operated in the Cameron Highlands in Malaya in support of other battalions. Whereas in the early days, we were confined pretty well to Negrisambila. But I should think from the 54 onwards, although Negri was our... I'm not right there. In fact, in about 1950-something, 4 or 5, we went down to Kluang. We moved from Seremban to Kluang, the battalion. And that was in North Johor. And that was an entirely different area.
In what way?
Well, no. I didn't mean it that way. It was not Negri. It was in Johor. It was just geographically it was different. That's what I meant. But I mean the jungle. It was more or less the same. The routine was the same, basically.
How long were you in the Malayan Emergency for?
Do you mean personally or?
Personally.
Yeah. Oh, I suppose. I'm trying to think. In the early days, in 48, the start of it, and 49 and 50 and 51 and 52, those four or five years, except for a period in England on leave, I was there most of the time. In 53, I came home. I was the adjutant of the Brigade of Gurkhas Coronation contingent in London, where we were doing the 13-mile march on Coronation Day with the Brigade of Gurkhas contingent. There were about 80 of us there. And then subsequent to that, I went back to Malaya for another stint of about a year, I think, in the emergency. And then I went to India, and I was in India for two and a half years doing recruiting in Nepal and in Darjeeling and Jalapahar. And then I went back to Malaya to the emergency again in about early 1957 for another 2 years, where I was commanding a company most of the time.
How was recruiting carried out in Nepal?
We had two main recruiting bases, which had been going since the division of India, since partition. We had one at Lehra over in India, but near the border of Western Nepal, and the other one was in a place called Jalapahar, which is really just above Darjeeling in the Sikkim area of East Nepal. And we used to establish camps in Nepal, in both adjacent to both these places, but on Nepalese soil, for the recruiting season. We'd man these camps, and we would recruit within those camps. That was the procedure, really. We used to send out retired Gurkha officers into the hills, and this still goes on today, into the hills to pick up likely lads who wanted to join the services, and they would come back to these bases in Nepal that had been established in the season, which was always about October, November. That was the non-rain, after the rains, it was after the monsoon rains, it was the best seasons to do anything in Nepal. It was October, November, that sort of time. And these retired soldiers would go out and bring in their recruits to these camps that had been set up, and there we would go through a recruiting procedure, and we would take them back to our depots in Lehra that I mentioned, and the one in Jalapahar near Darjeeling.
What was this recruiting procedure?
Well, it's nearly all geared to physical physical fitness. It's a question of coordination. It's surprising how many people walk with their right hands and their right feet going out at the same time. You know, and lack a bit of when they're put to it, they, without thinking, they can work normally. But if they're sort of put on a stage, so to speak, they start doing funny things. But it's mainly of physical stature, of fitness, rather than anything else. And of course, the Gurkha soldier, the Gurkha, living in his own homeland, is a very tough cookie. He's got great big legs because of the hills and the mountains that he walks over and the loads he has to carry on his back. So he's a very physically very strong person. But it's not everybody who passes the eye test or the ear test. It's a proper military medical. And you're looking for bright people, people that's got a certain amount of intelligence, you know, that look as though they make good soldiers. But I think probably the physical elements are more important than anything else.
Do you remember the names of any of the officers who were sent out to recruit?
No, but I could find. I haven't got any that I can.
But were they English or?
Oh no, it depends. It depends what you mean by sent out to recruit. Those people manning the base camps where the Gurkhas were brought in were all British officers, and they had their Gurkha officer support from regiments. But the people who went into the hills to actually bring back their 10 or 12 recruits were Gurkhas themselves. And they would go back to the areas they knew. They'd go back to their own villages and sort of, and they knew what we wanted, so to speak, and would get the right people.
Would a young man come in off their own bats?
Some would, but very few. I mean, Nepal is a pretty rugged country. You're talking about, you know, walks of 6 or 7 days. And these villages are very isolated. And in those days, early days, you see, it's 40 years ago, communications aren't what they are today. And some of these villages are being very isolated. The young men of those villages probably wouldn't know much about what, other than from a relation who might have been in the war or whatever. But I think these days, of course, it's a lot more is known about it.
Now, after the Malayan emergency had finished, what kind of experience did you have then in your service?
Well, we the emergency finished, I suppose, in 1959, and the battalion, our battalion, moved up to Hong Kong. And in Hong Kong, you had a number of battalions on border duty. The Hong Kong border, I don't know how long it is, but it had to it had bases all along it, and these were manned by battalions, not only Gurkha, but British battalions there as well in rotation. And you had at one end of the border with China, you would have a company base and platoons, and at the other end, and two or three in the middle. So on the border as a whole, you would have a border battalion with its companies and platoons based along it. And in those in the early days, you were really just maintaining the integrity of the border. It was a barbed wire border, and a lot of visitors used to go up to the border to look into China. They'd see the red flags of China flying from opposite the buildings opposite the border. And one of one's main problems, in a way, there's a village called Chateau Coq on the eastern end of our border in Hong Kong. And there was no actual barbed wire stopping people walking into. You had a sentry post, and you were able to bring coils of barbed wire across the road. But there was a certain amount of transport moving backwards and forwards. And you had a lot of visitors, I suppose, almost wanting to go into China to see what was going on. And so one of the main roles, I suppose, was not keeping the Chinese communists out of out of Hong Kong in a sort of wandering way, but keeping visitors from all over the world from stepping out of Hong Kong wanting to have a look at China. But your main role in at that time was the security of Hong Kong. It really was a question of manning the border, trying to get advance information of any troop movements on the other side, because there was always the threat of China possibly taking over Hong Kong. Now, the Hong Kong garrison, and this has been argued about a number of times, there was no way the Hong Kong garrison could have held back a Chinese army. I mean, but nevertheless, we were there to give advance warning of any such movement and approach. There were intelligence reports about what was going on. And the whole time we were there, certainly there was never any question of the Chinese actually attacking Hong Kong. But there was always the threat, there was always the possibility. And it was a huge business centre and a lot of pound and dollar interests in Hong Kong. So obviously there had to be a gesture force in defence.
Was it peaceful in Hong Kong or disturbed?
Hong Kong had its riots. The battalions had a dual role, really. There was the border duties and there was the internal security elements in Hong Kong. It's a very crowded place. It's bound to have certain trouble spots that arise every so often. And troops were called out on internal security duties in Hong Kong from time to time.
Did you personally go out on those?
Yes, I've been involved in one or two of them, yes. But it's amazing. The presence of a military force does subdue feelings quite strongly.
What were they rioting about?
Oh, dear. I suppose there are troublemakers in every society. In Hong Kong, there were people there who wanted to join up with China, who didn't, wanted to be part of China. But any excuse if somebody got hurt, For example, if a military vehicle had an accident and ran over a Chinese or a child or something, that was a riot potential, that sort of thing. It was. I don't think you could say that that there was an easy relationship between the Hong Kong people. But we did spend a lot of time on Hearts and Minds, and the whole of the Hearts and Minds project there, tremendous effort was started because of trying to help the people as much as possible. We used to have parties at villages, we would raise funds for villages, we would send troops there to play basketball and games. There was very much a Hearts and Minds exercise throughout the whole of Hong Kong. The military forces there were doing their part with the police to have a stable, happy society. And I think it worked.
Which years are we talking about? When
well,
you were there?
Well, we were there initially in 58, 59, this sort of time after Malaya, and then we were back there in the mid-60s, and then in the early 70s, and we all did tours in Hong Kong, and it really didn't change very much.